On RSN 927's Racing Pulse, welcome to The Verdict.
How do you rate Prince of Sussex compared to some of the best two-year-olds we've seen at this point in time?
He could be the best. He could be the third or fifth
best.
He could
be the best, you think?
The rest are even. They've been shopping the results around. A wet track on pace winner won the Golden Slipper, whose name I bet you we've already forgotten.
The Amici.
Yeah.
Oh, just, you didn't forget. There wasn't a standout in the super-duper two-year-old races, and why can't something rapidly emerge?
I mean, I like handicap racing. I think there's way too many set weights, weight for age races. I'd much rather see 98% of the program as handicap events because it gives everyone a chance. And I actually just like seeing big fields and competitive racing.
My mail is Peter Landis is having conversations with the creator of the Jericho Cup to try and get something happening up there.
Needs must when the devil drives.
Yeah, there we go. We will talk.
As we always say.
Gee, I hope that Jericho Cup for Landy's story is not a furphy because it keeps appearing on the rotation on our highlights reel. Welcome to The Verdict. Mickey Blue Eyes is having a couple of well-earned days off, and Sharknado and Lynch. What's a good one for Lynchy? the Lynch.
Lynchinator.
The Lynchinator. Join me.
Lynch mob, perhaps.
The Lynch mob. Well, there's only one of you.
Thank God. I'm singular by nature.
You're shrinking too, I've noticed, recent, across your
clean
presence.
Clean living, healthy eating. I'm just
hanging off you.
A bit, he's inspired by Adam White. Yeah, you can tell by the belt. The belt's looking like a bit of twine just hanging on.
No, I told you, I'd still be struggling to ride Tiger Roll at 12 stone in the Grand Nationals, so no problems there.
And forgetting the lack of talent in the saddle as well.
Yes, that's right.
Hey, I reckon the off-season produces the best subject matter for The Verdict, and there's so many interesting things going on. Had an interesting chat to Anthony Cummings just before about Libertini and her big win and the Anthony Cummings story in the context of the overall Cummings story, and we'll have a chat about what an interesting story his individual story is. Just a quick one before we talk about Damien Lane. I'm really curious, and we're hoping to get hold of Damien Lane, but we're going to have a chat to Simon Zara about the kid that became the champion after Damien Lane's blockbuster season, Golden Slipper, and the big wins in Japan. And also, I want to talk about gear changes off the back of the Doomben 10,000. Lynchy, I know you've got some interesting stuff there. And there's one or two other things as well that we'll get through as well. But Shark, that graceful storm, it was interesting, just the little things that jump out at you off the stewards report. I totally understand the position of the stewards, but it's interesting with the suspicion of race day treatment, how one set of circumstances is more believable than another, and I totally believe that the Maloneys have done nothing wrong on this occasion, but it's interesting that some go one way and some go the other, and veterinary records were the key there.
Well, it seems that they've been so hard on any similar or comparable instance in the last, 12 months, probably further back than that. Any nick on the jugular seemed to result in horse being scratched. And in this case, it hasn't. So it's inconsistent in that regard, but listening to the steward's reasoning there behind why they permitted the horse to run, okay, it makes sense. But surely in the other instances, there was reasoning why horse might have had mark on jugular and the horse came out. So it is an odd... I'm not across it in great detail, but listening to the explanation for it before, it does give some context for the decision.
Well, that's right. And the other interesting one will be the one that's hanging over from the championships with Princess Jenny and David Bridal,
and
the Sydney stewards are still deliberating there.
Well, that needs to be sorted. I mean, she's proved what a good filly she is winning in Morphettville, and doesn't David intend to take her to Brisbane for Oaks and Derbies and things like that? I know he rates her really highly, and, you know, it's just a shadow that's hanging over him that he doesn't need and the game doesn't need.
Absolutely. I think the greatest highlight of the weekend and the one that will have the most lingering effect was Damien Lane's four winners in 2 days in Japan, including a Group 1 yesterday in Tokyo, in which he actually defeated a horse called Primo Sen. He was on Normcore and defeated one called Primo Sen, who incidentally is a daughter of Moshin. So there's an interesting connection there. Simon Zara's waiting on the line. What I want to do, guys, is put some context into the story of Damien Lane, because I think he's now well and truly shot to the top of the stratosphere. Let's have a listen first to... We couldn't find an English call, so this will give us an idea of just how far away he went. This is the Japanese call of his Group 1 win yesterday. And then we're going to talk to the guy, Simon Zara, who, along with his cousin Matt Allerton, were the first to experience in the East the talents of Damien Lane. So let's have a listen to this race call. 50m, Well, that made perfect sense. G'day, Simon Zara. How are you?
Morning, boys.
Sounds like Matt Allerton at 3 o'clock in the morning. Oh, dear. Hey, what we can decipher from that race call is that the winner was a guy called Damien Lane. And he's a young jockey who's still young, but he's one who, when he was much younger, first came into your stable. Did you ever imagine that the Damien Lane who wandered in from Perth a few years ago would become arguably the greatest jockey in Australia?
Yeah, it was a bit of a surprise, but he might be young in age, but he's never been young in the head, so that's probably one of the main things that sort of got him to where he is today. He's a very cool sort of customer. You stand there with, Group 1 races, and his demeanour doesn't change from a maiden to a Group 1, so that's, he really soaks up that sort of pressure, and he doesn't make too many mistakes in those big races as well.
He won the Oaks for you, of course, didn't he, on Aristia this year?
Yeah.
Well, at what stage did you think, when you had him as a kid, I think he was 2 kilo claimer, wasn't he, when he came over or something, you thought this kid's actually got it and can really go through with it?
It was a bit of a long story. He sort of arrived and, that's how light he was. He had a front foot in the rear that wouldn't go with him. We had to put a bag of maize on it to make sure that it could take the weight for, so the whatever it goes. So that's how light he was when he arrived, and he's a bit of a kid, and he lived with Matthew and Leah, and just used to plod along, and he did a good job. He came over with a 2 kilo claim and nothing in the bush, so wasn't going to be an easy task for him to sort of get going. And look, he's had a lot of ups and downs in that time. But I remember at one stage he rode a winner at Bendigo on that Saturday meeting. Rang up and said, I think I want to go home. I'm just not feeling it. I can't get excited about it. And so we just had a chat with him and he said, get through the winter. And, if you're not airborne after winter, fair enough. You've got to give yourself at least 12 months and one solid winter. And he sort of did that. And then he came out of his climb and never looked back. So I remember him having a conversation with him at Caulfield one day. And I just turned around and said, you've gone past it. At the moment, at those stages, you had a couple of sour riders and said, you've gone past them. they just sort of, just keep going and you just keep improving.
That hump that he got through, Zach Purton, I remember talking to Robert Smurden about the young Zach Purton, and he was with Robert up at Ballarat for a while, and he said he's the greatest talent I've ever seen. As soon as you saw him on a horse, you knew it, but he said he wouldn't get out from under the doona. It's a character-building test that they have to get through. Is that what Damien had to get through very early on?
I think it was more. He missed home a lot, and the opportunities, like I said, because he had no claim in the bush, it wasn't though he was riding every day and getting opportunities. So he had to work even twice as hard. And we had to convince our owners to keep putting him on in the bush, which is not easy when they don't claim. And to a lot of our owners, that they were happy to have him on. And I remember even Michael Lane ringing me one day. I'm coming to get him. I've never heard the kid so low, and I said, just let him figure it out for himself. If you cotton wool them all the time and they get problems and run to mum and dad, they just don't figure the problems out themselves. And to Michael's credit, he sat down and didn't come over, and the rest is sort of history. So it wasn't always smooth sailing for him. He definitely had his ups and downs. But one thing he's always done, he's had respect for everybody. But also, he's had a great work ethic, and when Weary was at his peak of his powers, he was riding work everywhere, and jump outs, and riding in races, and driving from somewhere to somewhere. So his work ethic was second to none, and that's one of the biggest keys.
Simon, you spoke of his demeanour and that calmness, and I've seen it firsthand. I think we all have after the Golden Slipper. He was just so cool and collected, despite the fact he just won one of the biggest races in the country. I've stood next to him before a race in the mounting yard, and I nearly had to check for a pulse. Like, he's just that he's that laid back. Do you think that attitude helped him through that the ups and downs period, those low periods, because he doesn't seem to be a character that's prone to emotional highs and lows.
Yeah, definitely. I think, I just don't think he probably had a good think about it, and it was an opportunity that was, you know, there was any, like I said, you can go home anytime you want because it's still going to be there. So, you know, to his credit, he really stuck it out, and then he sort of come out of his claim, and he rode in town the whole time. So that was another, you don't find too many kids come out of their claim and go straight and stay in town the whole time. You find that they go sort of missing for probably 12, 18 months and then work their way back. And, example, Bo Merton nearly won a premiership 18 months ago, and he sort of had a quiet 12 months, and now he's starting to work his way back. So, you know, Jordan Child, same sort of thing. He's really starting to ride a lot of winners. So, you know, those guys have gone back and then are on their way back up again. And then, you know, guys like Damien never left. So, it's credit to him. And, and he's really worked on his weight. He's not a natural lightweight or anything like that, and he's always working on his weight. So, full credit to him.
All right, just a quick one. What's his greatest trait as a jockey? He seems to be so relaxed. I remember the Toast and Stardom wins, and even that win in Japan was a big swoop. What does he bring to the table as a jockey that maybe most of the others don't?
Well, I don't think he panics too often, does he? Like, even if he's three deep, I think he coming into me one day, he said, the most overrated comment, I was three deep, no cover, you know. But he just seems to keep him nice and balanced when he's out there. He doesn't panic. And that's probably his trait. And he's very natural. Like, we don't go out there and train with him. We actually don't even tell him what to do. We just walk out and he just tells basically the owners what he's going to do. So he's done his homework and rides very natural on how the race is run. So that's something that you can't teach. It just sort of comes naturally.
All right, well, he's a superstar, and you guys certainly played a role in his development. Just a quick one, Booker Goodwood. What's the story there? She's the third favourite?
Yeah, she's in great order. We had a good jump out here Friday. Just pulled up a bit average out of the Newmarket, so we sent her up the farm. Had 3 weeks down there on the grass, and she's come back. She had two nice jump outs, and she's going to go over there in great order. And generally one of her best runs is her first up run, so... she can draw a nice alley and, get a bit of luck. She'll be definitely a presence that we felt.
Terrific. Good on you, Simon. Thanks for that, mate.
No worries, guys.
And thanks for that insight into Damien Lane. Lynch, a couple of SMSs have come through. The nickname for Lynchy could be the Lynch Pin.
Ah, yes.
one here, Damien Lane knocking on the door for top five. No way done enough to be number one. Still way behind Oliver, Bowman, etc. And another one similar. Someone misspelt my name. Instead of Matty, they said Fatty. Please, Lane rides four winners in Japan, and you say arguably he's the best jockey in Australia. Ollie rode two Group 1s last weekend. I guess what I'm saying is he's rapidly getting to the top of the mountain.
Yeah, he's in the conversation. I mean, you know, there are different waves of riders coming through, aren't they? And he's in that wave of, 20 to 30-year-olds who's doing it. Just one final point on him, though. Very phlegmatic character. He's had probably...
You Google it? I think it's PH, Shark.
Like Weary sacked him off Humidor, didn't he, after the Caulfield Cup? And he just bounced back, didn't let that bother him. So I guess that's the resilience you need.
Yeah, he's been a tricky one for the media from time to time. I remember I had a story, big feature lined up for .com a couple of years ago, and he pulled the plug at the very last minute, which left me a little bit dissatisfied.
I've never had a problem with Damien Lane, to be honest. But
not me either, really, but I just remember that. We're going to take a break shortly. Nathan Exelby is going to... A couple of things I want to really get our teeth into. One is this continually curious story of Ben Curry, the bloke who's almost had Queensland Racing at ransom, and there's a latest development with his four-year disqualification and complications involving that about a potential appeal and so on. Nathan Exelby is going to continue to set the Ben Curry scene for us. And after the break, I also want to talk about, and I welcome SMSs as well, of gear changes that have either spectacularly worked or spectacularly have backfired. This is off the back of the Doomin 10,000, where Osmond Bulls had the blinkers and they didn't really do much. And Nature Strip had the bunny ears and maybe they did too much. So plenty to discuss, but we will take a break on The Verdict. It's 18 minutes past 9.
RSN 927's Racing Pulse presents The Verdict.
Guys, nothing will ever compare to the fine cotton era for exposing the true nature of things in Queensland racing. But, gee, it's getting close at the moment, isn't it? Nathan Exley is about to join us, Lynchy, but it just seems like one Keystone Copsy thing after another. There was a wrong saddle cloth, at Saturday night at Toowoomba. There was a jockey who shouldn't have been riding in town who was riding in town. It just keeps accumulating.
Didn't they call the wrong horse placed in a race a couple of weeks ago Toowoomba or somewhere? Yeah, look, it's just a debacle. I mean, you know, to have one mistake is
what's excusable. The old saying?
Well, to lose, I think it was Oscar Wilde, wasn't it? The importance of being earnest. To lose one parent is understandable. To lose two begins to look like carelessness. And I think that's really what's happening in Queensland. It's not just two, is it? It's two times two times two.
Yeah,
just...
and the central figure is Ben Curry, who continues to... intrigue us, basically, by his attitude, but is also the fact that he's had Queensland Racing held to ransom almost by delays and so on. But there has been a significant breakthrough in that story on Friday. Nathan Exelby is the chief racing writer at the Courier-Mail, who's going to sort of reveal all for us. G'day, Nathan.
Hello, Matty. How are you?
I'm well. It's not just Ben Curry. It's other stuff as well, isn't it?
Oh, it's just so humiliating for us up here, Matt. I heard you talking... about the saddlecloth incident that follows. You neglected to mention the fact the wrong horse raced at Rockhampton within the last six weeks as well. The wrong numbers, semaphore, declared correct weight on the wrong numbers, the jockey, and now somehow this saddlecloth incident must have gone past 10 sets of eyes and not one single person's managed to pick it up until after the event.
There's got to be, I mean, it's just unprofessional. I mean, are these race clubs professional outfits? I mean, do they place enough importance on these little one percenters that mean so much? What's the root cause of all this, all these stuff-ups?
Well, it's very notable that not one person has yet been held accountable for any of those stuff-ups you've mentioned. Three and a bit years ago, we had the integrity arm of the industry removed from the control body. So Racing Queensland bears the brunt of this criticism, but in actual fact has nothing to do with it. It all falls under the umbrella of QURIC, Queensland Racing Integrity Commission, which was set up in the wake of the Greyhound live baiting debacle. And look, QURIC has not been held accountable at any stage. The Integrity Commissioner, Ross Barnett, has been appointed to another 3 years, but surely at some point there has to be some serious questions asked of QURIC and why these stuff-ups keep happening.
Is QURIC too arm's length from the day-to-day business of running racing to keep a close eye on these things?
I think so, because obviously if it's under the umbrella of Racing Queensland, it affects their brand, and so then they have to act and say, why are these mistakes happening? Because it's costing our brand... It's damaging our brand and ultimately costing our brand money. But with QURIC removed from it, they don't have to deal with the consequences of these stuff-ups.
So who at Racing Queensland is asking the questions, Nathan? And if they're not asking them, why not? It would have seemed that it should be questions should be asked or QURIC should have been held accountable after one mistake, not after four.
And that's a terrific question, Chuck. And I would suggest part of that reason is that Racing Queensland is so beholden to the state government that they're not game to ask those questions because they're reliant upon the state government, who, to be fair, have tipped in a reasonable amount of money in recent years. But to be seen to be openly criticising the state government's, pillar of integrity, QURIC, they're not game to do it. And that would be definitely one reason why it hasn't happened.
I mean, Nathan, we had the business with Aquis saying they'd boycott it, but I think they've turned it round now, haven't they, and are going to have runners there. David Hayes had a lot to say about it as well. Is there a feeling that fields are being affected, that the quality of the interstate raiders is being compromised by this for the carnival?
Not for the carnival, no. I mean, Lindsay Park has had very few carnival runners over the years. Aquis has... removed that ban. We saw dubious win there Saturday.
Yeah.
In terms of numbers, it hasn't affected it. The numbers, field sizes at Toowoomba have been affected. They certainly have shrunk over a period of time, but as Matt mentioned at the top, there was a breakthrough last week, and there's more to play out on that this week.
Righto. What's the latest with Mr. Curry?
the four-year ban was handed down on Friday. That was two charges of 2 years each to be served cumulatively. Now, that will be, I believe, he'll put an internal review in to appeal that decision.
Well, it's just that, that jumped out at me a bit. There was an AAP story that said Benkore's lodged an application for an internal review of a steward's decision disqualifying. What does that actually mean?
Internal review is like our first level of appeals body up here. Right. It's meant to be an independent body from Keurig, but I think since it started, you know, probably 90% of the steward's decisions have been confirmed by the internal review. So I think the internal review has, you know, 10 working days or something similar to hand down a decision. And then when that comes back, if it's confirming the steward's decision, then you go off to QCAT, which is pretty much where it's all determined. So now, having said that, the big day this week is Thursday in the Supreme Court, where Ben Curry is seeking a judicial review of Racing Queensland's move to invoke AR55, and that's refused his nomination. So that's why he hasn't had any horses racing in recent weeks, and that's why all of those transfers happened last week of his horses, and he's moved out of his on-course Toowoomba stables. Now, if that were the stick, if the Racing Queensland of AR55 sticks, then Friday's proceedings at QCAT would become a bit of a mute point, because Racing Queensland would continue to refuse the nominations. If Ben Curry wins that Supreme Court hearing over Racing Queensland, then I would suggest he'll go back to QCAT. Given QCAT's history, you would back them to grant him a stay, and he'd probably be racing Saturday week.
Wouldn't they be then held for bringing the sport into disrepute, allowing a bloke like that with all these issues, you know, to be allowed back?
But what happens then, you know, on the back of Aquas saying, oh, no, we're re-supporting Queensland Racing, so if Curry is granted that stay, then does Aquas then say, no, we're off Queensland Racing again? Because there's all these other parts. There's a ripple effect with everything that happens in this Curry saga.
Yep. There is. I mean, I couldn't speak before on behalf of Aquas. They never specifically mentioned Ben Curry, but that's the obvious conclusion that was drawn. Mm. Huge ripple effect, Michael, and bear in mind, there's still the matter of another 35 charges against Ben Curry to be determined, plus another 5 swab irregularities, so that's still got a long time to play out. But QCAT, it pretty much determines, does the applicant have an arguable case, in which case they'll determine, yes, Ben Curry does have an arguable case, and then what's called the balance of convenience, and who does the balance of convenience lie with? And to this point, they have never sided with the industry. It's always been that Ben Curry has that balance of convenience.
Why does he keep fighting? I mean, it seems like there's overwhelming waves of evidence and massive amount of positive swabs and charges and all this sort of stuff. Is he just fighting every battle as it comes along and then not worrying about the next? Why is Ben Curry fighting something that ultimately he just can't win?
Well,
unless he can win in some bizarre twist.
He thinks he can win, and to be fair, he's won at every turn by going to the independent reviewers.
But haven't they been stays? They haven't been wins. Haven't they just been extensions?
Yeah. That's exactly right. So, I mean, his career's on the line. You know, you're looking at 4 years for those first couple, which people have observed as being pretty at the high end of the penalty scale. But then presumably with 35 other charges, those years will mount up further if he's found guilty on those. So he's got everything to lose, and, you know, so I guess he doesn't have any options. He can walk away and cop however many years Keurig give him, or keep fighting. And, you know, to say in some ways he's winning a PR battle, like he's certainly got his supporters there on social media.
I was going to ask you, has he got a band of supporters, or is he completely alienated from the industry?
No, I wouldn't say completely alienated. There's certainly, he's got a really rock-solid core of supporters there that have stood behind him from the get-go. There's some trainers who are staunchly against him, and then others who are sort of, I don't know, neutral on the whole thing, I guess, is the best way to describe it.
I was going to ask you that, Nathan. I mean, are the people who are behind him just basically punters who've won money on his horses, or personal friends? I mean, I can't imagine anyone in the industry, particularly rival trainers, is happy about this or can be supportive of him.
No, there's certainly, I don't think, I'm not aware of any rival trainers have come out and supported him, but there hasn't been a huge number that have admonished him either. Rob Heathcote was the most outspoken up here. He was very vocal on it, but felt like he didn't get the support from his colleagues that he felt should have, and he's retreated on it and hasn't spoken publicly on it for some time.
I just find it fascinating. Anyway, and I'm going to be fascinated for a lot longer because it's going to go on for a lot longer. Hey, Nath, just before we let you go, your take on the Doomben 10,000. We're going to have a bit of a discussion shortly about the merit or the folly of gear changes, and some work and some don't. And there was certainly a gear change theme about the race going in. But what was your take on the upset win of the Bostonian?
Yeah, I spoke to Chris Waller after the race about the earmuffs, and he said they will stay on until such time as James McDonald says that he feels they've done their job, and then they'll come off. So he wasn't putting the earmuffs down to the reason Nature Strip was slowly away. Look, it's an upset. You know, the Bostonian was here last year and around a sort of a listed Group 3 type level. He wasn't far away in the New Zealand Group 1 sprints, but it's a long time since New Zealand sprint form has measured up in Group 1s over here. So, you know, a huge upset. And I guess, well, Nature Strip, you know, the Nature Strip of 2 months ago would have dropped out and beaten 5 or 6 lengths. So I think they are winning the battle with him. And Osborne Bull's Doomben 1200 was probably always going to be some sort of a risk with his racing style.
Yes, it certainly was an interesting race on a number of fronts. Good on you, mate, and we'll keep tabs on you-know-who in coming weeks and also the Brisbane Carnival.
Cheers, guys.
You-know-who being Ben Curry, of course. Guys, before we take our next break, I just wanted to talk about your overview of the Doomben 10,000, and I did a piece on Sunday for the website about gear changes per se, the tool shed, what tools the trainers use out of the tool shed, which ones work and which ones don't, and the ones that punters, Shark, take the most notice of and the ones that they ignore and so on. And on Saturday we had, I thought it was fascinating going in. We had James Cummings thinking, I need to get Osborne Bulls closer in the run and ready to pounce. I'm going to put the blinkers on. Chris Waller almost having the opposite mentality, trying to slightly unravel Nature Strip. What did you make of the race, and what did you make of the success or otherwise of the gear changes?
Well, the muffs, I think, dulled Nature Strip to a degree at the start, and you took away, in doing so, you took away his main weapon, which is his blistering speed. So we're none the wiser as to whether he runs a strong 1200 or not, because the horse probably used up too much petrol early in the race, going from back in the field to some sort of positive position on or near the pace. So we're in the dark again with Nature Strip. Osborne Bulls thought the blinkers, you know, the danger with the blinkers is, and they're the gear change I think most punters would say, oh, blinkers on, you know, he's going to be this, he's going to be that. They can be applied for different reasons to different horses. And for him, I think it was a focus issue that James wanted to make sure he was just looking straight ahead and charging home and finishing at his best. He did that. Just the Bostonian got up on his inside and beat him. I think you'd say the gear change didn't have a negative impact on Osborne Bulls at all. It's his racing pattern that leaves him vulnerable.
Mm. No, I'd have to agree there. I mean, there was a great tweet from the estimable Tom Melbourne account after that Doomben 10,000. Osborne and I are going to knock off multiple alcoholic beverages off the wood tonight. Whoever's responsible for Tom's tweeting, take a bow, son, on that one. But look, yeah, with Osborne Bulls, that's what, 5 Group 1 seconds on the spin now? Seconditis in spades. It's his racing style, isn't it? I don't think you can question his genuineness. And I presume they wanted the blinkers on to focus him, try and get him to lay up a bit closer. As Shark said, blinkers and all manner of gear changes are used for multiple different reasons. And I'm sure we're going to go through this with some examples in a minute. They sometimes work and they don't sometimes work.
Well, that's
and,
right. You've done a bit of global research too, which we'll tap into shortly.
Yeah, ancient history research.
Because I am fascinated by, and the punter perception of gear changes too, Shark. Whenever you see, I jokingly said in a story that you should, if you want to pull off a plunge, whack in some synthetic hoof filler and put on some bar plates.
Exactly. Yeah, the bar plates, the dirty, dirty bar plates. There's some statistics going around for a while now about how poor they were, but there was a horse that won in them last weekend on a Saturday. So I think that the change that, or the gear application or change that punters sort of understand the least are the bit changes.
Mm.
And what that does, you know, the control aspect or the comfort for the horse in its mouth that different bits will have, and that can be really significant. Gary Mudgeway, I know he's been a mainstay in, you know, the pinhooking, the bloodstock trade sort of side of things in this country for many, many years. And now he's getting great results with different bits that have been developed to relieve pressure on horses' mouths and to help them breathe better and things like that. So if they get approved and they start being introduced into the system, there's a whole another range of gear that punters have to get their heads around. For me, it's those smaller changes, you know, that affect the comfort of the horse in the race rather than things to fire them up or coax them into some sort of effort, you know, that can often backfire.
I remember the one that people really believed in for a long, long time was Blinker's first time on a Zabeel.
Yes.
And I think it worked for Sky Heights and Might and Power, but there was a litter of steeplechaser Zabeels that it didn't work for. But yeah. It's amazing how people can get hooked on an idea about it.
I know, and I think, you know, there are a lot of urban and racetrack myths about this. I actually found an interesting debate here on a Betfair website about this, and the number of gear changes that can be made will just baffle punters for a start. But it says on average there's no advantage on horses with blinkers for the first time in sprint races. The advantage exists at 1400 meters or further. Presumably it relaxes them or allows them to lie up closer, and the more starts they've had without blinkers, the more impact blinkers are likely to have first time. So make of that what you will.
Kenedna was one that you...
Oh, yes, yeah. I remember at Flemington a few years ago, Kenedna won one of those fillies set weights races early in the autumn, and I think she had a rating of about 64, and the top rater at 85 or something. And I do remember saying to Darren Weir after the race, gee, that was a big performance, Darren. She's shown remarkable improvement. And he just said, it's all down to the blinkers we had her on first time today.
Tosin Stardom, was he one who just dropped out of the sky with blinkers as well? And away from Weir, obviously, they're just two examples that we randomly pluck, but there's Shark. Have you got any? When I do the 30-second form, which I do a lot, you know, when you just got this compulsion to have a bet under any circumstance, and I get the form up, I just gravitate straight to key changes. And if something's got blinkers on, I go, that'll do me. Have you got one that you use as a bit of a rule or a fallback position?
Not particularly, but as you say, reading the gear changes, being aware of what the trainer may be trying to achieve with them, which means understanding what the different bits of gear do. And maybe that's a great content piece for, you know, racing.com or somebody like that to go, and they may well have done it, but something to promote is an explanation of all the different types of gear purely for punters. Like, here is a crossover noseband, these are used for this, and get a trainer to explain what they use them for, so that when you see them in the form guide, you think, aha, that is used for horses that might need some control or might get a bit keen in running. It's a control piece. Yeah. And you can apply that thinking then to your analysis of the race.
Well, you can never have enough information, I suppose, although there always is analysis by paralysis on the other hand. But what is interesting in the UK in
well,
the last 12
months... Well, I was
going
to say, globally,
months,
some things are trendy in some places and not in others.
Well, in Britain, I know in the last 12 months, they have introduced into the form guides wind ops. So if a horse has a W by its name, that doesn't mean wet tracker in their form guides. It means now wind op, W1, it will have first run after a wind op, and then W2, second run after a wind op. It doesn't after the third run, but you know, again, mixed results. Some horses, particularly the jumpers and steeplechasers over those longer distances after a wind operation, they can show remarkable improvement if they can breathe properly for the first time. But again, there's no conclusive evidence. There's as many losers as winners.
Here we go. We've got an SMS. Jern Melbourne Cup blinkers first time. And that's what I'm going to ask for some SMSs on for listeners on gear changes that either worked spectacularly or backfired spectacularly. We're just going to take a short break, and then Lynchy, I want you to give us a couple of extreme examples of this from the UK. And then we'll move on to some other things. We're going to have a bit of a recap of Caulfield. I'm still fascinated by the girls in world racing dominating the boys, and whether we feel that there is an issue with the weight for age scale. There's been some spectacular winners overseas in recent days, and they've all been female. We'll talk about that shortly. It's 18 minutes to 10.
The Verdict for OTI Racing, where sport and lifestyle collide. Find out more at oti.com.au. RSN 927's Racing Pulse presents The Verdict.
It's 15 minutes to 10, so I want to have a chat about Anthony Cummings, who I find intriguing, and also this whirlwind of female dominance around the world. A couple of gear changes to come through, Lynchy, before you give us some of the more obscure ones. Stallion chains on mares, work that one out. That was from Hariba. Gelded Quinny from Oakley. I wonder whether that's the Quinny that we just spoke to, and who could do with a bit of gelding.
It is the ultimate gear change.
Lynchy, overseas, you've plucked some bizarre examples of extreme gear changes.
Well, there are two in particular from my youth that I remember. There was Vincent O'Brien, who was the Aidan O'Brien before Aidan O'Brien, if you like, the Coolmore super trainer. He had a colt called Marinsky, who was very, very talented, but a savage. And he used to have to race in a muzzle, which is an unusual gear change. And he was a Group 1 winning sprinter. He won the July Cup. He was probably European champion sprinter. And there was another bizarre sprinter called Yubi Dizzy, who didn't quite reach those levels, but he also had to race in a muzzle. He won at Newmarket one day and tried to eat his lad in the unsaddling enclosure.
Tried to consume his handler.
He did, yes. And then they banned him from Britain, and they tried to run him in Ireland one day, and they tried to fit the blinkers behind the stalls, and he tried to eat the barrier attendant.
Well, it's to be fair, the attendant had been rubbing the lotion on his skin.
So probably, yeah. But and I think, from memory, Mike Bite, the Cheltenham Gold Cup winner, ran in earmuffs. Earmuffs.
I was going to say.
Not a muzzle.
Well, he sounds like a muzzle horse to me, Mike Bite.
Yeah, yeah. That's
appropriately
David
named.
Haynes.
Yeah, Rebel Soldier.
Rebel Soldier. Now, I don't think
he used to put a Hannibal Lecter mask on.
Yeah, I think David still has nightmares about that horse.
Absolutely. Hey, we're going to listen to the South Australian Derby replay shortly. But first, Shark, I just wanted to get your take on Anthony Cummings. And to me, he's this guy who sort of, he's a sleeping giant, and then he goes bang, and he's done it with Libertine. Just as far as the big winners on the weekend, and just what an intriguing trainer he has been over the years. He's had his ups and downs, hasn't he?
He has. Look, the thing that stands out for me when you talk about Anthony Cummings is his want to throw seemingly outclassed horses into the deep end. And you sit there and you think, why is he running this thing that just won a benchmark 64 into a Group 1 3-year-old race? And invariably, they run very, very well.
There's been three or four that have won at 100-1 plus over the years.
And when they take their place,
five and a half star in the Derby a few years ago, do you remember?
Even as recently as this past autumn carnival in Sydney, I think the filly was called Mizzy and might have run a massive race in a Coolmore or something like that at 100-1 and very nearly run a place off what was mediocre sort of form going into it. So from the outside looking in, you think, this bloke's half mad. But he rarely gets it wrong when he sets horses a task. He must have a very good ability to measure the potential of horses.
His first winner was in 1992. And how many Group 1 winners do you think he's trained?
18.
20. Close. Very good, very good. Yeah. All right, well, he's back in business with Libertine. What did you make of her win at Scone?
Very, very strong. Great win. Everything you want to see from a fast young horse. Just sat there, cruised along, did everything right, and then when it was asked to go and win the race, the gears were there immediately. It's that change-up speed from coasting along to smacking your head in that makes her a very, very good filly.
Actually, it's interesting. We've still got officially 2 months left before the end of the season, haven't we? You know, end of July. And it talks to a point you were making here a couple of weeks ago, Matt, about the two-year-olds that, you know, it's often the late season ones that don't actually appear at the carnivals that end up being the best, and who knows whether this filly will go on to take that sort of rank as well.
Absolutely. You put it this way, I don't think Anthony Cummings would swap Libertini for the Golden Slipper winner or any of those other ones, that's for sure. All right, I'm still fascinated by the girl power of world racing these days, and there was a couple of examples internationally, Lynchy, which we'll talk about shortly, but let's set the scene by listening to the girl beating up on the boys in the South Australian Derby on Saturday.
Quafila led the way from Savio Chapada, then Secret Blaze. The filly's going well here. Quafila led from Savio Chapada. Mr. Quiggy's running on when it's all over, but the bird's flown, and the bird is Quafila. The filly's going to win the Derby. Quafila first. Second goes to Savio.
Well, Shark, I reckon it was ripe for a filly, because I didn't reckon the Colts and Geldings were much good, and Grinziger Star came out. But to me, it continues a bit of a theme where 20 years ago, the girls rarely beat up on the boys, but all around the world in recent years, not just recent months, it's been happening relentlessly.
It has been a good result for Lindsay Park again, and Kefila's, she's had some racing, hasn't she? You know, still a couple of months to go before the end of the three-year-old season. At start number 17, she raced as a two-year-old, stakes-winning two-year-old. There she is winning a Derby, and from a purely personal note, a very, very good result for our Zoustar Ziggy Bay colt, who's now a half to a Group 1 winner.
Shameless plug, took 51 minutes.
It did. Oh, well, I was slow off the mark today. But I think it was Peter Moody who I first took notice of making this point, that when the rules of racing in Australia in particular changed around the use of steroid treatment for horses and geldings and whatnot, the presence of those good geldings that were able to, you know, get the snip, focus on racing, get a little shot of something when they go out of the paddock for that one time and come back and they're ripping into it to counteract the loss of the avocados. Since that's been banned...
The Avos, we call them.
Yeah. Since that's been banned, the fillies and mares, they're the ones that have really come to the party. We lose most of our good colts off the track, so we take off that cream of the big, tough, burly boys that are already performed at the elite level, and we're left with the mares that get a weight advantage.
When did you come here, Lynchy?
1980... November 87, so right. Just after the carnival.
Well, that was... after the Kingston Town era, and you came on the verge of the massive era for the geldings. List is so
Beau
long.
Rogue, Superimpose, Better Loosen Up. That was
Rough
all in
Habits,
my,
Citizen. Yeah. I mean, there was an endless Durbridge. He was a colt, actually.
Well, I think the only top sort of filly, Research, won the Derby and Oaks in Sydney in the late 80s, a filly.
Yeah,
for
absolutely.
Barry Connors. But that was about the only... Let's Elope
Moody
won Melbourne Cup and Caulfield Cup, so...
Moody wonders whether there's a hormonal, naturally produced steroid advantage that the mares are experiencing. And to me, this tests the whole idea of the weight for age scale these days, whether we're calling the fairer sex when there ain't nothing fair about them and all that sort of stuff.
I think that is an interesting point. I mean, Shark's point's absolutely on the money about geldings not being able to get perhaps the treatment that they were in the past, and all the top colts, you know, getting off to stud, or more pertinently, being sold to Hong Kong from this part of the world as well. I think maybe there is a change in the way horses are just growing and developing now. I'm not an expert on that, but, you know, in every other walk of life, women are getting bigger and stronger in the human race, so why wouldn't the equine race, you know, sort of mirror that? And also the other thing is, because there's not so much money in putting fillies and good fillies and mares off to stud early, they are actually allowed to grow and develop to 5-6, where they actually hit their real physical peak.
Yeah,
and that is being shown on the racetrack. Maybe if we did allow the colts and geldings to stay racing, the colts to stay racing till they were 5 or 6, they would be braining these fillies. But the fiscal imperative for going to start is just too much to ignore, isn't it?
Regimate, by the way, I spoke to Jamie Steele last night. There's no update on Regimate right now from Racing Australia. Shark, is this something that's sort of flown onto your radar? Like, that dominant era of geldings is gone. Now it is the dominant era of mares globally. Like, Lynchy, we could list 20 great mares of recent times.
You go on from Zarkava, you know, Zenyatta in America, Trev 1-2 Arcs, Enables 1-2 Arcs, Winx here, you know, the Almond Eye. I mean, they just keep turning up every season.
Shark, does it make sense, given the recent shifting of the balance of power, that the weight for age scale remains as it is?
I think in any sport, and racing's not absolved at this point, that you have to continually revisit things and assess things as they change. And maybe we are in an era now, maybe it's just a little moment in time where the mares are dominant.
It's a 20-year moment
around
in time.
Maybe it is in the long storied history of thoroughbred racing, but alternatively, maybe there is a swing here that we'll see be continued, and at which point you have to ask, do we still afford the same advantage? Because it is an advantage. It's a massive advantage at the elite level as well.
Do you know, if you flew in from Mars and someone said, this is, say, Winx, this is the best horse we've ever had, yet
And she's getting a weight advantage on every other horse. It's already inferior. Therefore, what do you think the result will be? Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
It is odd, though. I mean, and it's relevant. I guess, you know, we've got this Caster Semenya debate going on, you know, in the world of athletics about hormones and having to have treatment, etc.
Well, she's effectively being nobbled, isn't she?
Yeah, you know, you don't get it in any of... I mean, great as Serena Williams is as a tennis player, she'd probably get towelled up by the number 300 man in the world if she was playing a singles game. Yet, with horses, it just doesn't seem to make sense, you know.
I've got a massive query on it these days. I don't think it is... I don't think anything in the world that was relevant 100... How long has it been around, the Wait for Age Scale?
Wait for Age Scale, 1840. Well,
I don't think
it?
Anything that was relevant in 1840 is relevant now, especially with the evolution of it. And I think it's time for everyone to have a serious think about this.
Here's the thought. People are getting bigger and stronger. I've long felt that we should change the Wait for Age Scale, that, you know, weight should be raised anyway to account for jockey sizes. If we were to do that, wouldn't it be a good time to rethink the whole weight allowance as well? If globally every jurisdiction could actually agree to do that,
that'd be something, wouldn't it? Cooperation over boundaries and borders. Wowee.
And by the way, Reg, your mate, Greg Nicholls doesn't move into the chair of Racing Australia for a little while yet, so it's certainly not something that he should have dealt with by now. But I would imagine, even without him being in that chair, this Regimate thing just goes on and on, and I think it might be part of this puzzle of the females. Shark, just quickly looking backwards and ahead, was there anything out of... there's been an SMS here having a crack at Johnny Allen's ride on Mr. Quickie in the South Australian Derby, and then when we look forward to next week with Group 1s in two states, what do you look at?
I don't think it was Johnny's best ride that I've ever seen on Mr. Quickie, but at the same time, Corey Parrish rode another very, very good ride on a long shot in a Group 1, and now he has two Group 1s. So you can't underestimate the ride that Corey Parrish produced, and you could say the same of the ride on the Bostonian in the 10,000. Brilliant ride, fantastic ride, and good rides get rewarded at the elite level. Good to see Dubious back winning that Champagne Classic in Brisbane, Group 2 effort there. I thought it was very, very good. He's been at the top, and what that does is it confirms that elite two-year-old form from basically the start of this season to the end. You know, when that Magic Millions race was on, he was up the head of the markets and he ran so well there. Now we're pushing towards June, and that form line is still getting ticks. I think it says a bit about that elite two-year-old form this season. Hopefully it throws forward into a really good group of horses into that three-year-old season.
He's been the constant factor right from the get-go.
He has been.
More of a tribute to his toughness
and durability. And
very well managed by Kieran Maher and Dave Eustace.
And Eustace, yeah. So.
Lynchy, what are you looking forward to in the next week or so?
What, in Australia?
Give us a quick... We've got a minute. Give us a global wrap, and there's, again, girl power here. John Gosden, Cheshire Oaks winner, which went through the roof, and there's been another one from Aidan O'Brien. Just give us a quick wrap of the international scene.
Gosden basically wrapped up the Phillies Oaks trials. Also called Medaya, won very easily. The Cheshire Oaks beat the stablemate. Interestingly, Frankie was on the wrong one that time. And then he won on Saturday the Lingfield Oaks trial with Annapurna. But the focus is really on the Derby. And again, there were four Derby trials over the course of the last weekend, and Aidan O'Brien won them all. Broome won in Ireland, Sir Dagenais won the Chester Vars, Anthony Van Dyke won at Lingfield, and Circus Maximus won at Chester. So I think the top five in the Derby, five of the top six are Coolmore Colts for the Epsom Derby. So plus ça change, plus ça même chose.
And don't forget Godolphin in France overnight, winning the 2,000
Persian
Guineas.
King.
Guineas
Persian
double
King,
for Godolphin.
Yeah, so it's all hotting up there for those Derby and Oaks. I suppose here we've got to look forward to the conclusion of the Morphettville Carnival and continued hijinks in Brisbane, haven't we?
Hijinks.
Every time they run a Brisbane race, it should be with the Benny Hill music in the background. Do, 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 do. All right, that's it from us. Good on you guys. We'll see you again next week. It's 10 o'clock.